Okay, the meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy will come to order. It is now looks like about 3:15 there. I can't see with the glare, but that looks about right. Thursday, February 8, 2011. We are in the Ramona Barnes Committee Room of the Alaska Capitol, room 124. Members present are Representative Peterson, Representative Sadler, Representative Pruitt, Representative Olson, and Representative Tuck, as well as myself, Representative Foster. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. As a reminder, please turn off your phones, if you could put those on silent or vibrate. Today we are hearing presentations on reports required by Senate Bill 220, the Alaska Sustainable Energy Act of 2010. In your packets should be the following: the Governor's Office 12-page report on how best to structure state energy programs, the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities 1-page report on retrofitting state buildings to improve energy efficiency, DOT's 1-page summary and 90-page report on using compressed natural gas to power vehicles, the Department of Revenue's 5-page report on creating municipal energy improvements financing program, and the Office of Management and Budget's 1-page report on a standardized way to collect data on energy consumption and costs. Please also let the record reflect that Representative Lynn has also joined us here. On the teleconference today, to walk us through this are Sarah Fisher Goad, the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority, Joel St. Aubin, and Diana Rotkiss of the DOT. And here in Juneau, we have Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, as well as Greg Coughlin of OMB. First, we'll start with Sarah Fisher Goad, who will explain the governor's report on how best to structure state energy programs. So, Sarah, please, for the record, state your name and title.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sarah Fisher Goad. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the Office of the Governor report and how best to structure state agency programs. This report did require an examination of the powers and duties of AEA and its relationship with the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. AEA has become a key agency for the planning of energy infrastructure and financing. Currently, we do this by issuing grants through the Renewable Energy Fund Grant Recommendation Program, and most recently, the newly authorized Emerging Energy Technology Fund Program. We have also managed the construction of many rural energy infrastructure projects and have provided technical assistance and training to local power plant and bulk fuel operators. AEA, in partnership with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, manages the Power Cost Equalization Program. However, since 1993, AEA has not had the ability to own and operate new energy projects or to hire staff to manage and carry out the programs of the Alaska Energy Authority. ADA staff currently does manage these AEA programs. House Bill 103 was introduced to address this needed improvements to AEA's authorizing statutes. This legislation does restore AEA's powers to own and operate new energy projects and allows AEA to hire staff to manage its programs. In 2008, I just wanted to give a bit of history without going into too much detail at this point. In 2008, the board of directors for ADA and AEA changed their bylaws to allow the hiring of one ADA staff person as the executive director of AEA who does not report to the ADA executive director. So the AEA board appoints an executive director, and the ADA board hires that executive director. So that is the most recent change with respect to allow ADA and AEA to move forward with their separate and distinct missions as State of Alaska corporations. And I know, Mr. Chairman, that House Bill 103 hasn't been noticed for the committee, but I didn't want to go into too much detail, but House Bill 103 has provided this next step through this process of ADA and AEA's relationship, allowing AEA to truly have staff that are AEA staff and not ADA staff for the purposes of managing the programs. a couple issues that with the coordination and some adjustments to some or some recommendations to programs we are addressing that are addressed in the report is AEA manages the bulk fuel revolving loan fund, and the Department of Commerce and Community and Economic Development manages the bridge loan fund. And there is a recommendation that this program should be merged into one program with two different levels of services. We are working on that that legislation that would accomplish this merger. And we are also working on addressing the needs of the Commercial Energy Efficiency Loan Program. There are a variety of programs to address energy efficiency needs throughout the state for either public buildings and residential homes. However, commercial buildings are also in need of some financing. And so AEA and the Department of Commerce and also ADA are working on developing options to address this program. The coordination efforts through the governor's office, there has always been coordination through the governor's office for the management of energy programs and, of course, other programs. The governor's office has a position that, although currently vacant, the energy policy coordinator will provide additional focus and coordination for energy programs and policies that cross the lines of several state agencies. So the mission of this energy policy coordinator will be to help the commissioner, staff, OMB, and the governor's office ensure that the state energy resources and energy programs are devoted in a way that produce results which advance the state's energy policy priorities. So once this position is filled, there is the recommendation that this person should further evaluate the services and programs for energy programs in the state to measure the results and make additional recommendations if necessary that would provide additional changes beyond this report. And I think the overall message with respect to the report is that services and programs should be evaluated to really review their effectiveness in providing a value to the communities and residents of the state of Alaska. So the reorganization of and reporting structure of these programs should be implemented only if there is really evidence supporting a reasonable expectation that the program effectiveness will be improved. So I think that's a bit in a very quick summary, the purpose of the governor's report to the legislature. And with that, I am available for questions as they relate to the to either my comments or the relationship of ADA and AEA and the AEA powers and duties.
Thank you, Ms. Fisher-Goad. Are there comments or questions from any of the committee members? I do have a quick question here. Philosophically, I'm wondering, curious what your thoughts are on, you had mentioned creating a energy coordinator position. What are your thoughts on if there was a Department of Energy? I think this issue came up last year, and I just wanted to maybe get your general thoughts on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I recall the inclusion of this report back to the legislature from the governor's office was really to address on whether there is, a need for the Department of Energy. And I think, in general, I think what we have found is that, any coordination of the variety of projects and programs for energy across several state agencies and creating a Department of Energy may not provide any additional services and enhancements of those services to the communities and the residents of the state of Alaska. And so I think the energy policy coordinator in the governor's office has also always played the role of the coordination, would be able to coordinate those programs without making a restructuring process that would move, for example, AEA programs or commerce programs into some type of other entity.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? No questions. Okay. We appreciate your input. Next up on the teleconference, we have Joel St. Obman of the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities to talk about retrofitting state buildings to improve energy efficiency. Joel, please state your name and title for the record.
For the record, my name is Joel St. Obman. I am the Chief of Statewide Public Facilities for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Senate Bill 220 requires that the department, working with other state agencies, retrofit at least 25% of all state of Alaska public facilities that are in excess of 10,000 square feet no later than January 1st of 2020. To begin this effort, the department is currently gathering utility bills from the past 2 years for all state-owned buildings that meet the 10,000 square foot criteria. Most agencies have provided this information, and we are generating energy use indexes in order to prioritize the buildings from least to most energy efficient. This process will be ongoing and will utilize the information gathered from the implementation of the standardized methodology for state agencies to collect and store energy consumption and expense data. The department and the Alaska Energy Authority have collaborated on this approach to prioritizing facilities. Additionally, because completing the work as cost-effectively as possible is essential, the department intends to group projects by geographic location to the maximum extent feasible. This will assist us in expediting project completions, reducing project costs, and maximizing resources. However, it may mean one group of facilities includes many departments with different funding sources, and that energy retrofits to facilities are not completed in the exact order of their baseline energy use index. At the same time, we have issued an RFP for energy performance contracting and are currently negotiating with three energy service companies. The three contracts are anticipated to be awarded later this month, with energy audits starting in March and energy conservation measures starting installation this summer and fall. This will be a multiple-year process to reach as many facilities as possible. Initial funding for the energy efficiency retrofits projects will come through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act from the U.S. Department of Energy. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation is the recipient of this funding on behalf of the state of Alaska from the U.S. DOE. $10 million has been allocated to improving energy efficiency of state buildings. This funding must be expended by March of 2012. Once those funds are committed, funding of the energy retrofit projects will be through the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund Program, which is administered by AHFC, as well as other potential sources. It is anticipated that some of this year's projects may be funded by a combination of the ERA funding and revolving loan funds. Prior to the passage of Senate Bill 220, the department had previously completed energy retrofit projects under two phases of energy performance contracting. The first phase of energy performance contracting, completed in 2006, resulted in energy cost avoidance of $366,000 in its first year. The second phase, completed in 2009, resulted in $793,000 of cost avoidance in its first year. In total, 16 facilities that were over 10,000 square feet, or nearly 10% of the buildings that fall under SB 220, were retrofitted under this prior effort. Five of these facilities were managed by the Department of Administration, three by DOT, and eight by the Department of Corrections. If I can take any questions at this point.
Thank you, Mr. St. Aubin. Are there any questions of the committee? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that report. And it says here in 2006, it resulted in energy cost avoidance of $365,000, roughly. And then what about 07 and 08? Was that just 2 years that program was there, or was there no activity in 07 and 08?
No, the Representative Tuxer, the chair, the energy savings are continuing to this date. We just were reporting the first year's cost avoidance. So the cost avoidance is the dollar value of the energy saved in that year. So we are continuing to save dollars.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you. Question, the 25% of all Alaska State public facilities that we are retrofitting by 2020, is there money set aside for that, or are you coming back? I mean, obviously, we had the initial $10 million from the ARRA funds. Is there additional money out there, or will we be seeking it, and where will we be seeking it, from the feds, or will we come into the state on that?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, the funding source that is identified at this point is the Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund, the $250 million revolving loan fund that the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has set up. So it will be, projects will borrow money from the AHFC and pay that money back through realized energy savings to fund the projects.
Okay, I see it. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, do we have further questions or comments? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. St. Albin. Next, we have on the teleconference Diana Rutkus of the DOT to tell us about using compressed natural gas to power vehicles. So, Ms. Rutkus, please state your name and title also for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Diana Rotkiss, and I am the state fleet manager with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. This report, as presented, and it was released on January 31st of this year, was produced by Mercury and Associates for the Department of Transportation for SB 220. And it concluded that compressed natural gas is a feasible fuel for certain Alaska fleets, and expansion of the program would be beneficial towards Alaska's sustainability efforts. The first pilot program, or phase one as recommended, would enhance the existing fuel infrastructure and increase the number of vehicles and equipment using compressed natural gas by the municipality of Anchorage, the Anchorage School District, and the state of Alaska. Part of the provisions of phase one would be upgrading the five existing compressed natural gas stations within the municipal boundaries, acquiring a fuel management system for state bulk fuel tanks to manage existing fuel use and future program savings, conversion of 25 state light-duty vehicles, 4 school buses for the Anchorage School District, 4 solid waste trucks, and 2 transit buses for the municipality of Anchorage, and contracting with or the designation of an intergovernment program coordinator who would facilitate the finding external financial support, such as federal grants, to allow the program to move into additional phases, working with the City of Anchorage to acquire clean city status, which also opens up federal grant programs, and going about getting significant buy-in from the public and private sector for long-term sustainability of the project. The one-page report that I provided goes on to give economic advantages and disadvantages, as well as the 90-page report that you have. It covers how CNG is used in other states that have had success with this. And I'm available for any questions.
Thank you so much. Are there any questions? Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the in this pilot program, the vehicles that were selected, are these high mileage vehicles? Are these vehicles that, because I see we have 25 state light duty vehicles, are these like the 25 most used light duty vehicles? I imagine with the school buses, you know, they're going to be used quite a bit in the waste trucks. I was just kind of curious about the state trucks.
Representative Tuck, through the chair, what they identified, they started with the vehicles for the state that are, they looked at high mileage vehicles that stay within the municipal boundaries in order to be able to refuel gas at the natural gas CNG stations. So yes, we would be looking at the highest use vehicles.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Compressed natural gas is being used all over the world, and so it's a proven technology. My only question is, our supply of natural gas in South Central is projected to be running out in a couple of years, and I know just a few test vehicles like this will not use up a large quantity of gas, but do you think it's wise to start this program now when the supply of natural gas is iffy?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, one of the economic disadvantages that was pointed out by the Mercury and Associates was the additional gas storage required in Cook Inlet to meet peak winter natural gas demands. So that was identified as part of the study.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along the same lines, I'm reading your second bullet point at the top saying expansion of the program would benefit Alaska's sustainability efforts. I'm not sure quite how it fits sustainability. I mean, natural gas is as finite a resource as any other hydrocarbon. How does that qualify as sustainable?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I believe that Mercury identified the expansion of the program. They were looking at greenhouse gases and the availability, the future availability of compressed natural gas as a two-sided coin, and looking at the future of natural gas sustainability in the form of, words are failing me at this point. And I don't have the report in front of me, but when we look at sustainability of resources and sustainability of going forward with a fleet that uses less of just regular fuel, lower costs, higher engine use or higher engine performance and longer lasting vehicles, I think was where they were taking that comment.
So compressed natural gas vehicles cost less and work better than gasoline or diesel fueled?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, they do not cost less. There is a vehicle premium on most hybrid type vehicles for compressed natural gas. The premium is $16,000 to $24,000 per light-duty vehicle. That's over the cost of what the fleet would normally pay for a like vehicle. However, on the opposite side, what you do have is you have a much cleaner engine, so you have less preventive maintenance needs. You have a longer engine life. Those both have been proven in fleets in the lower 48.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Pruitt, and then Tuck.
A couple questions here. I'll start with the first one. I see that there are five, you mentioned there's five existing natural gas stations within the municipal boundaries. Where are they located, and are they located in areas where there's centralized fleets, or are these places that can be accessed by individuals that may not be in a fleet situation?
Representative Pruitt, there is only one station that is considered a public station, and that one is over in the Spinard area. The other stations all belong to the municipality of Anchorage or Elmendorf Air Force Base.
Okay. And then kind of the second question that I would have toward this is obviously there's – so far we're talking mostly about – obviously state vehicles, and obviously it sounds like even the access to fill up would be for state vehicles. Is the goal here just to do this for the state? Is there an ultimate long-term goal to show that this is a feasible option for personal use? What is the benefit? Because obviously there you mentioned there is an incredible cost per vehicle for each of these vehicles.
Yeah, Representative, through the chair. The long-term goal in a program such as this would be a public-private partnership. In order to have fueling stations that pay for themselves, you must obviously have an incredible amount of fuel that flows through them to allow someone who is going to invest the kind of money that it does to build a large station, which is $500,000 to $1 million, for it to be profitable. So in the end, you must have more than just the state involved in this. In the case of the municipality of Anchorage, where they are seeing a success and a payoff, is in compressed natural gas school buses. They fill overnight on a time fill. They go back every night. They plug in. When they take the school bus out in the morning, it's filled up. That's already proven to be very successful. They would like a whole fleet of them. The same is true with solid waste trucks. We don't have any here in the city. However, in the state of Utah, solid waste trucks and transit buses, as well in California, they use an incredible amount of fuel, and they do pay for themselves over the life of the equipment. It is much harder to see that kind of savings on light duty equipment when you're talking about $16,000 to $24,000 cost increase, and then the cost of having to put in refueling stations.
Follow up.
Did that answer your entire question?
Yeah, I think so. Just one follow-up that I had, will there be, it be necessary, as we talk about school buses, which while they may have the component that we help pay for them, they are run by private organizations. Same thing with the waste collection trucks. Are we expected, or is the understanding there that we would be subsidizing these organizations so that they can participate in this, or is this something that we expect them to join with us on and they'll realize the savings over the course of time?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, with the Anchorage School District buses, those are the buses, those are not the contract buses, those are the buses that actually belong to the Anchorage School District. And the solid waste trucks, there are two solid waste service organizations here in town, one is private, one is public. And so in that case, and including the transit buses, all of those belong to the municipality of Anchorage, and the expectation in the study was that the upfit over and above the actual cost of the replacement of those units would be funded through a phase one of the pilot program by either grants or legislative dollars or some type of government help, I guess you could say.
Okay. One last follow-up. And has there been interest from private sector groups or companies to join with us?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, only in providing us fuel.
Okay. So there has not been any other fleet, any other groups out there that would operate fleets of any type. I'm not just specifically talking about buses and whatnot, just of any type that have shown any interest in partnering.
Not at this time.
Okay.
Mercury and Associates did go, they have talked to a couple of local bus companies. However, they are cautiously awaiting to see what will happen.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to note that on the line, we have Bob Bream, Rosie Pickett, and Stacy Schubert from AHFC. And I just wanted to give you the opportunity to make a comment or ask a question, if you like, on this or any of the previous topics that we've touched on. Are there any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Bob Green. I just wanted to offer a piece of information. Earlier, there was a discussion about the revolving loan fund and We have a write-up on that element. If you would like us to forward that information to your office, we could send you an email hard copy of the backup data for that revolving loan fund.
Absolutely. We'd appreciate that. Thank you. Representative Tuck has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little bit of state. I know that NSTAR had outfitted their fleet at one time with clean natural gas. You saw them on their lights, but you saw the bumper stickers too, and that was, boy, probably going back 15, 20 years ago. And I think they still have some vehicles on the road that were originally retrofitted. But just looking at the charts, just wanted to point out a few things just in the study. Clean natural gas tends to be two-thirds the price of a gallon of gasoline comparable. And it's interesting to note that if the vehicle is originally designed with this type of high-octane engine, that the power and fuel economy goes way up rather than retrofitted. And I believe that these vehicles that we're talking about right now in this pilot program, are these retrofitted or are these designed with these engines for the presenter?
Ms. Rikus? Sounds like Ms. Rikus, are you still there?
There we go. Thank you. Representative Tuck, through the chair, we were muted there for a second. The vehicles as designated in the first part of the study, starting with the 25 light-duty vehicles, those are retrofitted. They are an OEM-warrantied retrofit. However, this is not something that comes off the floor of Ford Motor Company or Chevrolet fully ready to go with compressed natural gas. It goes to a different ship-through company. The school buses and the solid waste trucks are a more advanced fit with compressed natural gas. Those are, we have had some larger companies such as Roush Engineering. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They have put a lot of money into these retrofits, and therefore their how they perform and their longevity is frankly superior to their diesel partners in that area. Transit buses. In Europe, those buses are come out as an entire package. Here in the U.S., depending on the bus company, it is a retrofit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. I have two questions. You mentioned that the pilot program would require $5.3 million from the legislature to accomplish those. What kind of have you received any kind of reception, warm or cold, on that number?
Mr. Chairman, the report just came out on January 31st, so this is really everyone's first glance at this particular study. And so we have received neither warm nor cold.
Thank you. The other question
these
I have.
These are our first introductions.
Thank you. The other question I have is the economies of scale for this. Is it such that it's something that maybe only is used in Anchorage or Fairbanks? Did the study address whether or not it can be integrated into rural areas?
Mr. Chairman, the study did not. What it would take to move either liquid, to have compressed natural gas in the rural areas would be even to Fairbanks, the movement of liquid natural gas and conversion up there would add extra cost at this time. The study did recommend that if a pipeline were to be run and it became cost-effective to have compressed natural gas in Fairbanks, that we look at expansion up there, especially with the air quality issues.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Peterson.
I just had a comment that when I was in Washington, D.C. at the National Energy Conference a couple of years ago, I was standing along the street and saw the local city bus going by, and there was a big ad on the side of it saying that it was run on compressed clean natural gas. So there are places that that do have compressed natural gas that they're using on a regular basis. And I think as time goes on and the demand for vehicles like this increases, I think more companies will manufacture vehicles and the price will go down. There may not be that $16,000 to $24,000 additional cost to get a vehicle that runs on compressed natural gas. Just like anything else, if you produce more of them, the price of them usually goes down.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, just one last one here that you might have mentioned, but I may have missed. What is the energy content of CNG compared to gasoline or diesel? I think you hinted on it earlier, but is it more? Is it less?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, I'm sorry. Your question, what is the constant?
What is the energy content of CNG compared to either regular fuel, gasoline, or diesel?
You mean, okay. I had to think about that for a second. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, are you asking about what the difference between 1 gallon versus?
Yeah, if you took the compressed natural gas equivalent of 1 gallon of gas or 1 gallon of diesel, is there more energy in that or is there less?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair. I'm not sure that I guess I have seen it quantified as that. What we look at is on the individual vehicle, what are we going to, you know, gain or lose in energy, and then the cost per gallon equivalent to perform at that rate. And to give you an example with the school buses here in Anchorage, they love their school buses. They are performing exceptionally well, but they have difficulty going up the hillside. The CNG vehicles that we have had in the past, they performed exceptionally well, but you couldn't put a plow on the front of a truck. A lot of those things have been overcome here in the recent years with newer retrofits, and so you would not see any energy loss or any performance differences in the new vehicles compared with the old, using them in the same program.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that kind of gives me an idea. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Hearing none, thank you so much, Ms. Rodkiss. Next here in Juneau, we have Jerry Burnett of the Department of Revenue here to tell us what's involved in creating a municipal energy improvement financing program. Jerry, please state your name and title for the record. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jerry Burnett. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Treasury in the Department of Revenue. And the Department of Revenue was tasked with doing a report that addresses the financing programs for energy efficiency and renewable energy projects on residential, commercial, industrial project through property tax assessments. That would be a new program in Alaska, but in 2008, the first program of its type was started in Berkeley, California. There's 20 states that have such programs, and the acronym for programs of this type throughout the country is PACE, which is Property Assessed Clean Energy Programs. The financing mechanism for these is very similar to what you would see with a local improvement district financing in a typical community, where the city or the municipal government, county, city, whatever the municipal government is, puts a special property tax assessment on a residence. And normally, under current programs, that's used for water, sewer, paving the streets, sidewalks. Under this type of a program, it is used to, on a voluntary basis, for an individual property owner to allow them to finance energy savings or clean energy projects. Unfortunately, in July of 2010, the Federal Housing Finance Authority, which governs Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, says this about PACE financing programs. Says the FHFA, and I'll quote, the FHFA urged state and local governments to reconsider these programs and continues to call for a pause in such programs so concerns can be addressed. First liens for such loans represent a key alteration of traditional mortgage lending practices and presents significant risk to lenders and secondary market entities and alter valuations for mortgage-backed securities. So at this point, throughout the United States, these PACE programs are kind of on hold while the federal government sorts this thing out. And it happened that we had a high level of real estate defaults throughout the United States at the same time as this is going on. However, having said that, it's not an impractical program conceptually for if that can be worked out with the with mortgage lending practices. There are some specific Alaska challenges. Since PACE programs are administered at the local level, and we have 162 local governments in Alaska, and only 38 of those have property taxes implemented. So it's not something you could apply in all places in Alaska. If you're going to have this operate through Alaska, it will require statewide standards and some statewide administration of a program. We do, on the other hand, have some advantages because we have had the weatherization programs and rebate programs in Alaska Housing, and so we have developed expertise in energy savings and auditing. And if you look at the practicality of this financing, looking at the October report to the board of Alaska Housing on the success of the rebate program, the 9,000 rebates that had been paid at that time, the average cost, not considering the rebate, for the work done on homes was $10,800, with it an average annual savings of $1,580. So to get a 10-year payoff on this type of a loan is very practical. And we do have there are standards in place of people who could do that at the state level. So the recommendations in the report would be that if a PACE or similar financing program is established, the qualifications would require that local governments create PACE districts in order to participate, that local government would be the ones that would administer the property tax collections and lien implementation, but there would be a statewide issuer of bonds to finance the local to provide the local government financing need, and uniform statewide standards similar to those used at AHFC, or maybe the same ones as AHFC for determining energy savings and allowable costs, that the legislature consider, if making a PACE program, consider providing for a revolving loan fund to provide upfront capital for program startup. It could be then replenished through financing over time, but since you're working with a number of local governments, there's probably only four or five local governments in Alaska that would be capable of doing this on their own and getting the financing. And then we would have to work with the Federal Housing Finance Agency to establish standards that would allow for the PACE program to work with the mortgage lending community. With that, I'll answer any questions I can, if there are any.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Ms. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually heard about this a couple of years ago, that there was a program in Berkeley, and they were specifically installing solar panels on the roofs in housing areas mm-hmm. there, and then they got allowed to pay it off over 10 or 15 years on their property tax assessment. And so that program has been stopped now totally, do you know? Or?
Through the chair, to Representative Peterson, the state of California and Sonoma County, California, and one district in New York are currently in litigation with the Federal Housing Finance Authority over standards so that they can actually do the program. But it is kind of on hold, and they may be doing some with commercial property. I'm not aware, but I couldn't find any evidence that anybody has an ongoing program that hasn't been. But there's litigation going on. There are people working actively with the federal administration to try to make this work. Some of these programs had standards that allowed loan to value up to 110% of the value, and when values fell and people had to continue to, you know, these things had to be paid off along with the mortgage loans, it created a burden on the lenders, so to speak.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? I have one question. See, the Alaska Municipal League is here in Juneau this week, and I'm just curious if you've heard anything from them, any of them, on whether or not they're pushing for this hard or if it's just kind of waiting for us to act.
Mr. Chair, we have not heard anything in the Department of Revenue, and our debt manager is active with the Government Finance Officers Association statewide, and he hasn't heard anything from local governments pushing this, is my knowledge.
Thank you, Mr. Burnett. Okay, next here in Juneau, we have Craig Coughlin of the OMB to report on a standardized way to collect data on energy consumption and costs. Craig, please state your name and title for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Craig Coughlin. I'm a policy analyst with the Office of Management and Budget. I'm here today to report on Section 39 of Senate Bill 220. Specifically, it's the requirement for OMB to develop standardized methodology for the collection and storage of energy consumption cost data. OMB, the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and Department of Transportation Public Facilities work together to develop a module that will be added on to the Alaska Retrofit Information System that will allow state employees to do data entry from wherever the state through a web portal, through the internet. Once all the data are entered into the system, the system will then be able to be queried by facility type, facility size, occupancy, geographic location throughout the state, and then that information can be used for managing energy consumption and costs. Also dovetailing with Joel St. Aubin's presentation, it'll allow the prioritization of retrofit opportunities. The timeline for this is, it's my understanding that the heavy lifting has been done on the programming for the module. They're in the final stages of testing, and once all the bugs are worked out, we'll launch into live data entry.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? That was actually going to be my question, the timeline. And so you say, you had said soon, is that what we're looking at in the next month or next 6 months? Or
again, that's my understanding is, barring any wild glitches, that in the next month or two, we'll be launching that.
Appreciate that. Comments? Okay. Well, I appreciate the update there, Mr. Cochran.
Thank you.
Any comments on any of the reports that we've seen today? Seeing none, that wraps up today's hearing. On Thursday, we will continue the discussion on Senate Bill 220, the Alaska Sustainable Energy Act of 2010. We will be hearing from the Alaska Power Association, from Crystal Enkvist, from the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, which is Gwen Holdman, the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, which is Hannah Gustafson, Cold Climate Housing Research Center, which is John Davies, and the Alaska Division of Public Assistance, which is Susan Marshall. We'll also have a hearing on House Bill 39, which is Representative Pete Peterson's bill to require a utility applying to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska for a new or revised rate to have a refund procedure in place. And as there is no further business to come before this committee, this meeting will be adjourned at 4:20. Thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you.